At Triathlon Show, episode 61. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and today's episode is all about the performance and physiology of cycling and running in Olympic distance triathlon, although I will say from the go that there is a lot of things that you can take away for other distances as well. The reason that we call this interview and this episode Olympic distance triathlon is that that is what my guest's PhD thesis was called and what she investigated in her PhD thesis. This guest is Naroa Echevarria. She is an assistant professor at the University of Canberra, and she has been working with British Triathlon, the Australian Institute of Sports, and has been to the Beijing Olympics. She has been involved in a lot of ways in the application of sports science, so working with elite athletes, especially in British triathlon, Tim Don, Vicky Holland, the Brownlees a little bit, and so on. So this is a great interview. You'll get to hear both the science and the applications of running and cycling in triathlon, how to train, how to race, how cycling affects your running off the bike, and so on. So let's dive right into the interview with Naroa Echevarria. Okay, it's my great pleasure today to welcome Naroa Echevarria to That Triathlon Show. Welcome, Naroa. How are you today?
Hi, thank you. Yeah, really good. Thanks.
And you're all the way in Australia, in Canberra. You're working at the university there. What's your role exactly?
Yeah, so at the moment I'm working at the University of Canberra here in Australia, and I'm in a lecturer position, an assistant professor position, where I get to teach undergraduate students, supervise research students, and also do some applied research together with different organizations.
And the topic and the reason that I contacted you in the first place was that I found some of your research related to your PhD thesis that is titled Physiology and Performance of Cycling and Running During Olympic Distance Triathlon. I was looking for the science available on like brick runs or running off the bike, simply put, and you literally wrote the PhD on that topic. So I think that you're the perfect guest to talk about that. But in addition to that, can you just give us a very brief overview of your background, of the different roles that you've had and what you've done so far in your career?
Yeah, sure. So I'm from the Basque country in Europe, and I did my undergraduate degree in Gasteiz. But part of that was to do an exchange year in the UK, in Cheltenham. So that's where I got into physiology, sports physiology. So I decided once I finished my undergraduate degree to go back to the UK to do my master's in Loughborough, where I did my master's and started to work with British Triathlon at the time. I really got into the sport. I've always been a bit of an endurance sports fan myself, being a bit of a runner. I kind of started to implement the concepts that I was learning through my master's with real athletes, with the British athletes at the time. And everything snowballed from there. Then I came to Australia for a year to work at the AIS. Then I went back to Loughborough to work for the English Institute of Sport for a couple of years before I came back again to Canberra. And, since I've started to do some work in applied research, obviously, continuing on from my PhD work, but also expanding it to different sports, and lecturing at the university now for about eight years or so.
Perfect. And are you allowed to name drop a few of the elite athletes that you've been working with, if there are some names that the listeners would be familiar with?
Yeah, sure. I hope they don't mind. I'm sure they don't. So,
I won't tell them.
No. Look, I had a great pleasure to work with a lot of athletes, some that were more senior and some that were developing at the time. So we had Tim Don, Stuart Hay there. We had different female athletes that are doing really well now, as well, with Vicky Holland was in the development program there, a few of the others. So Will Clark, we did a little bit with the Brownlees as well, so mainly on training camps because they weren't actually based in Loughborough at the time, we had some work that we did with Alistair and John Lee in the lead up to the Beijing Olympics as well. So yeah, some exciting athletes and exciting times had.
Definitely. And let's get into the main topic, which is physiology and performance of cycling and running now. And you have a few different studies that were part of your PhD that will be the foundation for this discussion. And so it will be kind of a lot of science, but let's also, since you have that application background, try to make every point as applicable as possible and give some tips and advice for the listeners for if there are such applications that they can derive from these things that we'll talk about. So I was thinking that maybe the first study that we should discuss here briefly is physiological assessment of isolated running does not directly replicate running capacity after triathlon-specific cycling. So that basically talks about how pure running is different from running off the bike. So can you talk about what you did there and what you found?
Yeah, definitely. So as part of my role as the physiologist working with triathlon at the time, was to answer questions such as, how the run is affected by the previous two disciplines, which was the swimming, which still is, I guess, the swimming and the cycling sections. Our questions were mainly related to Olympic distance triathlon, I guess. So I wanted to kind of contextualize my comments in that we weren't looking at sprint or kind of Ironman distance triathlons, but it was mainly Olympic distance. However, most of the concepts are applicable to some extent to the shorter or longer disciplines of triathlon as well. And I guess, as you say, I was in a great position to be able to see what the athlete needed at the time what were the challenges that the athletes were going through when they were training, and trying to figure out the best way to help them in that process of becoming better and improving their performance. And one of the questions there was that obviously by the time they get to the running stage, their body has obviously gone through quite a fair bit through the swim and the cycle. And we wanted to see whether their physiological status for the run at the time in a race or competition scenario was reflective of the running assessment that we would do in the lab in isolation. So usually the physiological assessment of a triathlete would be done in different stages and on different days for the run and for the cycle and for the swim as well. But obviously the information, I guess, that we were getting from doing those assessment items in the lab were perhaps not the most accurate because they were done fresh or without any preceding cycle exercise. So we compared their running ability with and without any cycling beforehand, and we basically came up with information and I guess with data to say that, you know, the capability of their athletes, of these athletes, when it came to the running stage in competition was not the same as when we were doing the lab work in the lab when they were fresh. So we basically considered the fatigue they accumulated through the cycle and how this was going to affect, especially the first few minutes of the run.
Interesting. So can you elaborate a little bit about that? Does that mean that, for example, athletes that perform better in the fresh state on a separate day in the lab for the run test did not necessarily perform as well as other athletes when they had to do a run test off the bike in a fatigued state?
Yeah, that's definitely true in some cases. It's also true that some athletes are more affected by their previous cycling than others are. So it is quite an individualized response even. The other concept there is also about the fitness that an athlete would carry out on the cycle section compared to the running fitness. So, for example, if we have an athlete who is a very efficient cyclist, then they are very good at not accumulating too much fatigue during the cycle leg, so that their running of the bike is very similar to their running when they are fresh. Some other athletes find the cycling component of the race quite demanding, probably because their fitness during the cycle section is not quite as good as on the run, and they basically suffer the consequences of that cycle section on the early stages of the subsequent run. So I guess it's a bit of an art, as it is always when you are coaching and getting, you know, the best performance out of an elite athlete. To balance out, you know, how you prepare them for the cycle section, but then how do you also, reduce or minimize the fatigue that will come from that into the next section. At the same time, we were going through different, successful experiences in races. And one of the things that, athletes should think about is that the harder the cycle section it is for them, the harder it is for everyone else too. Therefore, they can take advantage of making the cycle section quite hard and fatiguing their opponents for the running section. So, and I know that as a matter of fact, that a lot of really good round triathletes have used that strategy in order to maximize their chances to win overall. So yeah, it's a really, really interesting topic.
I think the Brownlees would be a perfect example of doing the bike as hard as possible and then really reaping the benefits on the run because they are so great at running on tired legs off the bike. One thing that I want to piggyback on is when you mentioned that your fitness level on the bike affects your running off the bike. In this study, you had all the participants bike at 65% of maximal aerobic power. So it was all the same relative fitness. But does that mean that, for example, if an athlete has a maximal aerobic power of 400 watts, then even if then they would perform better, maybe on average, compared to an athlete that has a maximal aerobic power of 350 watts, even though it's 65% that cycle test is performed for both athletes?
Yeah, well, look, it's that's a really good point and really good question. We did make the cycling intensity relevant and individualized to their capacity. So that's why everyone cycled at 65% of their maximal aerobic power. So that's the same relative intensity theoretically for everyone. However, you have to think about how some athletes have a really great capacity to produce high power outputs for short periods of time. And those athletes would have a tendency of achieving a high maximum aerobic power Which means that their 65% of that maximal aerobic power might be a bit higher than for someone who hasn't got the capacity to produce such a high power output maximally, but they are actually quite efficient at sustaining a high percentage of that for a long period of time. So that's where it all gets a bit exciting, because you've got athletes that have a high cycling efficiency with not such a great maximum capacity, versus some other athletes that struggle to sustain a high percentage of their maximum capacity, but they are actually really well placed for high intensity bursts during the race, and for example trying to get into a breakaway and so on. So I guess is the comparison between the diesel and the high performing cars that have a high capacity to get into the higher intensity efforts, and those athletes that prefer to sustain a similar intensity throughout the whole cycle section. So it is a bit of a game, strategic game, as to how you play your strengths, in that cycle leg, and how you can make the most of the weaknesses of your opponents, I guess, at the same time.
Got it. And are there any other applications or action steps that came from this study that we should talk about?
Look, I think one of the main things that came out of this is that, and everyone is aware of this, that the planning of a triathlete and the training intervention that goes to make the most of what they have is to maximize their strengths, but also work hard on their weaknesses so that they can actually maximize their capacity. I think it's really important to think of how the tactics of the race play an important role as well, and knowing how to make the most of the race situation so that it would benefit your strengths and you can get the better outcome, I guess. The other thing that I would like to talk about briefly is the cycling ability of some triathletes that might actually not be natural cyclists per se, they would benefit, or they can actually benefit a lot from improving their technical skills, so that they can actually reduce the physical effort they need to put in during the cycle leg, because they have greater technical skills. So we at the time, a few years back now, and things are evolving all the time with triathlon at the moment, but we saw that in the females especially, there was a great chance to improve, improve their ability to get at the front of the pack at the end of the cycle, just by being able to sit behind someone and being able to save a lot of energy, because they were good at descending. They didn't have to accelerate and stop and accelerate as much, because their technical skills were better. Therefore, they had fresher legs by the end of the cycle leg, compared to someone else that was at the same time at the same place, but their power output, for example, was much higher, significantly higher during the effort. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, in summary, that you can get to the same point in the cycle leg by having to push 20 to 40 watts less on average, if you maximize on your technical skills. So that's another thing to consider as well.
Yeah, that's great. And a recent example of that is Flora Duffy in this World Triathlon Series, who's head and shoulders above the rest, both in terms of strength and power on the bike, but also technical skills and how much less energy she has to produce coming out of corners and so on. It's just jaw-dropping how great her bike handling is and how she can really benefit from that compared to the opponents. And one point that I want to make as well for many listeners that don't do draft legal racing, this can be useful in non-draft racing as well and long course triathlon. And the thing that I'm thinking about is working on your swim and exiting the swim further up the field. Because if you're a back of the pack swimmer or mid pack swimmer, but you're a strong biker and you need to overtake people time and time again, you're burning matches and your cycling power output is much more variable than if you are at a much clearer space further up the field after the first transition after the swim. So even though you may think that the swim is just a short portion of an Ironman, so you don't need to work on it, you can save a lot of energy and through that be much more fresh for the run if your swimming is up to scratch. So the next study that I want to talk about is cycling attributes that enhance running performance after the cycle section in triathlon. And that is relatively related to what I just said about the variable and versus constant power outputs. So what did you do for this study and what did you find?
Yeah, so one of the things that we were thinking and pondering about at the time was that as the triathlon venues, triathlon race venues changed to the kind of CBDs of big cities, the actual demands of the sport were changing as well. So traditionally, triathlons were held on the outskirts of bigger cities, where the cycling section especially was performed on roads that usually were an up and back sort of cycle section, where the roads were quite flat, not many corners or turns. Therefore, the technical skills weren't so high. But then the intensity of exercise was actually much more steady state. But I guess the transition of the sport as it's become more popular and, there's been, sponsoring and so on happening. The cities that are hosting those events, have a much more technical course on the bike. So the demands, the physical and physiological demands of the cycle were changing, quite dramatically. So we wanted to see what the actual demands were by making the athletes cycle through a protocol that was quite a challenging one. I still get people come in and tell me that these studies were the hardest they've ever done, and they've gone through a few of them. And what we did was basically make them cycle through short and very high intensity efforts of different durations throughout the 1 hour that we made them cycle for before they went on to doing the run. So I guess anyone who's done a cycling effort, in a steady state manner will say that when you actually go hills or when you are going up and down in that intensity, usually that interval training exercise is much more demanding and it requires different types of energy systems, as we know, different, types of muscle fibers and so on. So we basically compared, the same, mean power output that the athletes achieved, which was 65% of maximal aerobic power. But we looked at the physiological responses when they were cycling at a steady state intensity at 65%, and when the same mean power output was achieved for the 1 hour, but the way that mean power output was achieved was by going way above and beyond the 65% of maximal aerobic power, alternating with sections where the intensity was much lower than 65% as well.
And what did you find?
Yeah, I was kind of waiting for that. Well, what we found was that the physiological demands of a stochastic type of exercise is much higher than when you are exercising steady state. Again, some athletes are more genetically prone to being good at, you know, variable intensity exercise than others are. But there is a lot of, I guess, preparation that can go into making someone go pretty good at variable intensity exercise. So that's, I guess, one of the aims was to inform coaches as to what the physiological demands of racing were so that they could adjust their training intervention and strategies to accommodate the demands of the race. Because at the end of the day, you know, athletes are preparing to perform at those races. And if we don't know what's actually happening and what are the demands of those specific races, we cannot prepare an athlete to be best at that type of race. So yeah, we just profiled the courses. We knew that the demands were going to be variable, and we got coaches informed so that they could you know, maximize the training process to make the athletes you know, good at coping with those variable courses.
Yeah, and to give some context of this, how this variable power output and on variable courses affect your running, the quantitative results that you found were that on a 9.3-kilometer run time trial off the bike, it was 42 seconds slower on average after that variable power output, which had the same mean power output compared with the steady state cycling. So 42 seconds for a 9.3-kilometer run, that's a lot considering that the mean power is the same. So for sure, something that the listeners should take away if you are racing non-draft racing, where you have the opportunity to control your pacing and not be so bound to tactics that you would be in draft legal racing, then learning how to pace yourself properly and trying to cycle at as much of a steady state as you can is definitely a good takeaway to get from this. And do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a bit of a conservative approach, which is what most people kind of take out of this study. I guess my take on it is that if most people are going to try and do that by not changing their pace so much, whoever that trains to be able to cope with that, and whoever that can drive, you know, the change of pace in the cycle race can actually fatigue everyone else and get you know, the best out of the overall performance. So I guess there are a couple of different ways to look at it. My take on it is that the more you can prepare for that sort of exercise, stochastic exercise, you can actually you know, get a better result than someone who hasn't got the capacity to do that, and they choose to be a bit more conservative and cycle at a steady state result. As we know, you know, the physiological adaptations that you get from training, especially in any sport, but in endurance it's definitely true, is a result of the type of training you do and the type of stress that you place in your body. So instead of doing steady state type of training sessions, what I would do is try to stress that anaerobic lactic system, which is the maximum aerobic power that you can produce for a short period of time, and teach your body to recover from it. So, you know, doing short recovery sessions between the efforts, so that your body basically gets better and better prepared to cope with those demands. So, yeah, let's be adventurous rather than conservative.
Give us an example of a workout with stressing that system and with those short recoveries.
Yeah, sure. So I guess, you know, as we all know, you know, the training sessions that you undertake during a week and during the months are trying to stress the different components of your energy system so that you are actually improving on all different different areas. But one of the things that we know, for example, example is that if you choose to improve your anaerobic capacity, which is basically the capacity to produce a lot of energy during a short period of time, the consequences of that are obviously lactate accumulation and hydrogen ion accumulation, which causes acidosis and therefore makes you want to stop or have to stop. You can actually improve that anaerobic capacity and the way you deal with that drop in pH by actually doing exactly that, those sort of efforts. So if you perform those sort of efforts with a short recovery period, your body becomes more effective and efficient at recovering better from those sort of efforts. So I guess whatever hurts the most in training is what you should be working on in order to get better at it. So I don't know, something like doing, you know, 400 efforts with, you know, only a few seconds recovery would be a good way of, you know, stressing that anaerobic system and improving at, you know, going hard and high, but also recovering from it. So yeah, it's,
Is that 400 meters on the track, you mean?
It could be. No, I was talking more about running. And it could be on the road as well as the track. But yeah, I guess different times during the season have different aims and goals that the coach is trying to achieve. And, you know, one of the goals could be, for example, to increase your aerobic metabolism. And one way of doing that is by, going for an easy jog early in the morning when you are, when you've been fasting for 8 hours and you are trying to teach the body to mobilize your fats. But then obviously we know that in order to perform high intensity quality sessions, we need to stock up on our glycogen and carbohydrate loading is going to be an important factor, which means that for almost for every session that you do, you can manipulate whether you are actually targeting fat mobilization versus quality efforts and anaerobic capacity and so on. So it's all a bit of an art, as we know, and the coaches here have a hard job and task of, you know, bringing it all together, because obviously you are playing with multiple sessions a day where you are trying to time your nutritional intake to maximize the outcomes of the and adaptations from all these different training sessions. So yeah, hats off to all the triathlon coaches that do a brilliant job in trying to, you know, bring everything together.
Yeah, and I do agree with you about that aggressive approach. Definitely, when you are on the elite end or just front pack age groupers, definitely trying to take control of the race. And even non draft racing these days, 70.3s at the elite end is very much a variable power output affair. So definitely agree with you on that front. And my point about steady state, trying to keep an even pace, is maybe more directed towards the average age grouper than those front packers and the elite athletes, just to clarify that. Finally, keeping the discussion on training and interval training specifically, your study called High Intensity Cycle Interval Training Improves Cycling and Running Performance in Triathletes, that compared different kinds of intervals, so some longer ones, those 6 to 8 times 5 minute efforts, versus short high intensity efforts, there were 9 to 11 times 10, 20, and 40 second efforts. So you investigated or compared those two training protocols. What did you find in that study?
Yeah, so obviously, as the sequence of the studies came along, we first, characterized the demands of triathlon, verify them in the lab, and I guess the last stage of it was to be able to do something about improving the capacity of these athletes to perform well under those conditions. And what we did was compare longer, more traditional intervals that were 5 minutes long intervals with some of the shorter and sharper efforts that went anywhere between 10 seconds and 30 second efforts at higher intensities, obviously, than those sustained for 5 minutes, which made it quite interesting to see how, you know, athletes were going through the different interventions. Both interventions proved to be beneficial in order to improve performance. And I guess it depends. It really depends on, a lot of people ask me, you know, which one would you go for? And obviously, we found that the longer efforts got a better outcome for the running section, to improve the running section, and the shorter ones sort of helped with the cycling as well as you know, the running performance. I guess the answer that I sort of give is that it really depends on the person that you are working with. One of the you know, beauties of doing research, I guess, is that it's a generalized outcome that you get out of it. So it's a group situation where you've got a group of athletes that you bring together, you make them do a certain type of exercise, and as a group, they give you an indication for the outcome you might get out of those interventions. I guess the difficulty when you are talking to an athlete one-on-one is that you don't have a group of people anymore. You have to take the concepts that the research has developed and apply it to the person that you have in front of you. And I think that's the, I guess, the difficulty sometimes of translating research outcomes into specific athlete training interventions. And I guess when I try to do that, I try to translate what I found in my studies and trying to, you know, advise an athlete, a specific athlete, as to what they should do, is to look at, you know, their abilities at the time. So to measure what they can do and then manipulate the training intervention to increase the capacity that they are lacking on. So for example, if I have someone that is a diesel type athlete who goes quite well under steady state conditions, I would probably approach the training intervention by using short and sharp, you know, 10 to 30 second efforts, because that's what they are not going to be so good at. And that's basically the area where we have most, you know, most capacity to improve upon. If you take someone that is really good at doing, you know, short and high intensity efforts, more of that sort of work can only get them a little bit better. Whilst if you did something that they are not that good at, the options and the room for improvement is greater. So I guess it's always a good idea to make someone, you know, train a different way that they haven't actually trained before, because the way the body adapts, they are always going to be better at doing something that they are used to. And when you bring a different element, a new element to that training process, you actually see benefits straight away. So if someone is good at steady state type of efforts, make them do short and sharp high intensity efforts. If someone is very good at that top end, but they struggle to sustain a high percentage of that maximal capacity, then I would make them do the 5 minute long efforts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And how can somebody find out whether they're a diesel or short and sharp intensity prone athlete if they don't have access to a lab? What's your recommendation?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. Look, I would probably make them go out and put themselves into a race situation and see if they have the capacity to change pace comfortably or not. That would be a good test. If you train in a group, you will probably know the one that is very good at leaving everyone behind with a few Ks to go or a few meters to go, and everyone else kind of is left that, you know, they're hanging. They don't have a change of pace. Then you would be a diesel type. But those people that are, you know, very good at maximal, at the maximal capacity, they might struggle to maybe keep up with those that sustain a high intensity for a longer period of time. So yeah, I think it's actually a good situation where you should maybe compare yourself with others to see how you would probably rate, you know, with the others in those sort of abilities, I guess. And to be honest, most of athletes know, most people that do triathlon know what they struggle with. I guess it's a different matter when they decide to do something about it or not. So I think it's not so much about identifying what you are lacking. Most people are pretty good at that. It's actually making a conscious decision about doing something about it. And I guess the good news is that you can improve in any area that you are not that great at. It's just a matter of working on it. Everyone tends to train what they like or what they are good at. It's really hard to sometimes make yourself do training sessions that are not of your liking, or they are actually hurting. They do hurt a lot. Those are the sessions that are actually good for you, I guess.
And I'm going to make an educated guess here for the benefit of, for example, my fellow Finns, where winter is coming and there are no more races and not too many group rides left. If you have no idea what you are, then you are probably more likely than not a diesel type athlete, because that, I think, is the majority of age group athletes. So that, I think, that would be a good starting point, and then you can find out in training. I just want to reiterate the results that you got from this study that we're talking about here, and that was both groups, both the shorter and longer intervals, improved by about 10% in cycling sprint output power. So that's a great improvement. 20 second sprints only, so there's a rather large variance, of course. But then there was also an improvement, small to moderate, in heart rate, blood lactate, and perceived exertion in a 1 hour triathlon specific cycling. But then in the 5 kilometer run test, only the long interval group had a substantial decrease in runtime, and that was 64 seconds on average. So that's a big improvement. And anything else that we should add in terms of applications and actions?
I think one of the main concepts that I learned through going through this process is that it's really important to know exactly what races you are preparing for, and it's often quite hard to be able to prepare for different distances within a season. So I think it's important that people have a clear goal. I think it's also important to be able to have downtime in training, as well as harder periods of training where you are actually overloading. One thing that I find challenging sometimes with endurance type of athletes is that they don't like taking days off, or they don't like taking a week of a lower, volume and intensity of training. But I guess the way I look at it is that to be able to peak and get a great result, you also need to be able to come down and rest. So you can either choose to, perform at maybe 90% of your ability throughout the whole season consistently, or you can choose to target specific races where you're going to go 100% of your capacity. But that means that, in other races at different times, you will be performing at 70% or maybe 80%. So, I guess it's a matter of, prioritizing, making sure that you periodize and you have a periodization plan for your training for the year, where there are highs and lows in both volume and intensity of your training.
Very good points. And I was just thinking when you talked about rest there, that one of the best things that my coach has implemented in my program since we started working together is one complete rest day every single week. That's one of the best changes, one of the best things that's ever happened to my endurance training throughout all the years. So, and I think that's something that many listeners would benefit from, because as you say, many athletes are afraid of taking rest days. Okay, we have a few...
Just quickly, just to make everyone think about how the body works, you actually don't adapt from the exercise that you do until you allow the body to rest and adapt from it. So not the person that trains the most is going to adapt from it the most. And I guess it's a bit of a trick, because a lot of people think that the more exercise you do, the better outcomes you're going to get. And it's actually when you are resting that the body adapts. You can actually do an awful lot of work that may not translate into adaptations just because you are not resting enough. So you are actually doing a lot of hard work for very little gain. It's better to be smart about it and maximize the adaptations for the work that you actually do. So just something to think about when you are thinking about the ratio between rest and exercise.
Definitely. And I only have rapid fire questions left for you, three of them, and let's keep them to 20 seconds or less.
That would be hard.
So starting with, it's going to be hard. I'm going to challenge you. The clock is ticking. What's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports or high performance sport or your field of expertise?
I look at different magazines. I keep an eye on the conversations that I have with colleagues. The ITU website I follow a lot. Anything that comes kind of into my inbox from the network that I've developed over the years, really.
You need to subscribe to this podcast and add that to the list, I think. Who's somebody in triathlon or your field of expertise that you look up to?
Look, there is a lot of people that I look up to. I'm really lucky to have a lot of mentors in academia, but also within the applied sports science, area. And being here in Canberra, I get to do research with some of the top researchers with the sports science. So yeah, I'm very lucky to have a lot of people influence me.
Give us one name.
I can't give you one single name. Okay. For example, I've got Ben Bright, who was a coach that I really learned a lot from. Mark Pierce, a scientist that I learned a lot from in triathlon. And then I've got a lot of people here like Dave Martin, David Pine, that are at the AIS that I've learned a lot of. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. And finally, what research topic, your own or somebody else's, are you most excited about right now?
I'm doing a lot about gut health now, gut permeability in athletes. I'm doing some work with nutrition with Louise Burke that is quite exciting, and some work in triathlon that I'm finalizing and new projects coming up. So a lot of exciting stuff happening.
Perfect. This has been Naroa Echevarria, and we have been talking about running and cycling performance, and it's been a real pleasure getting to pick your brains on that topic. So thank you for coming on the show, Naroa.
No, thanks very much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to you and seeing how passionate you and all the followers are about a great sport that is triathlon. So keeps us all challenged and entertained, which is great.
All right, I hope that you enjoyed that interview. You can find the show notes on thattriathlonshow.com, and you can, as always, contact me and send me questions and feedback on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and that's Michael with a K, or tweet me on Twitter, where my handle is @scitriat. In the next episode, we will have Jacques Devore on the show, and he is a strength training coach and cycling coach, but his primary focus these days is strength training for cyclists, and he has been working with some very top-end cyclists and countless age groupers, and he has developed his own strength training concept that has turned out to be extremely successful for cycling. It's called Maximum Overload, for cycling, and he has a book with the same name that has relatively recently been released. And we talk about the maximum overload strength training program and how it can benefit your cycling and your triathlon on the next episode. So stay tuned for that. Also, I want to mention that for some time still, I have my free Olympic distance intermediate to advanced training plan with 7 to 11 hours of training per week available on Training Peaks, that you can get it for free using the discount code FREEPLAN17, all in one word, all caps. I'll have the information on the show notes. You can also go to scientifictriathlon.com/freeplan and you will find all the details there. So scientifictriathlon.com/freeplan. Be sure to check it out and use it and let me know what you think. Thank you as always for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.